Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello, hello.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Oh, yeah, baby. What's going on?
I want to show you all something pretty cool. And this is kind of, it's a little bit AI related, but it's adjacent. And I promise you it's worth it because I want to show you just the pace of development here. One of the things that I've loved playing with is, like, you know, years ago, like big into 3D models and stuff. And I just found this cool model on Replicate, which, again, I invite everybody to just go play around and experiment with these tools. Go to replicate.com. You'll see all sorts of different AI models there. And I found this one by a developer called Furtaz, and it's called Trellis. And what it does is it takes a image and then converts it into a 3D model. And I'll give you a demo of this in real time. Okay. Brian was reacting. We were looking at the image they had was like the sandworm, just like a thing of a sandworm. I did this before, but let me upload a, you can put multiple images, by the way, of the object.
Oh, wow.
But I have just one image, which I had GPT-4 make for me, which kind of wanted a Blade Runner-esque car, and it made that. So you can see this image. It's in a background, all that. And so now I'm going to go back to this tab. I've uploaded this here, and I'm not going to change any settings here. I'm just going to click Run. And again, I just took a really cool 2D image from ChatGPT.
Yeah, and it looked like the prompt would have been like Blade Runner police car digital art.
Pretty much exactly what I wrote, Brian, except for digital art. I think I used Spinner. I used Spinner from Blade Runner, right? So we're watching this generate. And so this is going to take, I don't know, maybe a minute.
We're seeing, looks like kind of like a command prompt stuff, like it's running a script and updating mm-hmm. you. You see a bunch of rendering bits.
Yeah, so Replicate's great because what they do is they have a bunch of servers that can handle different kinds of AI models. And I've shown you stuff before, like using, I don't know if we did it on here, but I showed like an incredibly fast generator that was doing images in like 0.3 seconds, which was insane. And so it depends on the server speed here. This is accessible to anybody. Go to replicate.com. I am not a paid sponsor, just a big fan of their accessibility.
Holy moly. Wow. Real quick in the chat, Robbie was asking, tell me this can spit out 3D printing options. I assume so. It looks like it's got a fully bitmapped 3D. Wowie zowie.
Look at this. It created.
That is now a
3D asset. That the file, I forget the file output that it gives you, but it is it's a mesh. It's got all of those details into it. And let's see what my cost per was 62 seconds. So it took a little over a minute, but you can see I can zoom in. And again, if I added more images, it would be high quality, but we got the front, we got the back. We're looking at an asset made from just a 2D image. And again, if I uploaded more examples of what I wanted to designs and stuff, and like I could probably go into ChatGPT and give me like a top view of this, whatever. Amazing. And so I'm going to go over in the behind the scenes here. I'm going to go to my dashboard and I will tell you what it cost me to run that prediction.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Min Huang, while you're doing that, pointed out that if you needed background doodads, like just what that is absolutely perfect. I had a similar thought. I was thinking a lot of those kind of, you know, God games where you're sky-based real-time strategy, when you zoom in enough, even when they were made by humans, that's about the level of rendering quality that you would get. But you know, it's not quite, I'm drawing too much power. Hang on, I'm going to mute myself. You guys take over the show.
All right. So my total cost so far, I think, has been like, that was 7 cents to generate that.
That's nuts to think what that would take from the moment of like conception for an idea to get the general premise. I mean, and obviously as a 2D image, it's you know, crazy. But then to spit that out as a 3D image, just to think of the work that used to go through that. And that's, you know, when we talk about job automation or job loss, where I don't know how to do the math on it, is something like that, where what is being created that otherwise would not have been professionally done, right? Like what is worth now? Like, what is created when now it's like, okay, you have these 3D models that you wouldn't have otherwise had, and you never would have made sense to do, right? Like, it's just, there's all this new stuff that's possible.
Well, there's an entire market for people buying 3D assets and kits and stuff from people. Mm-hmm. And I think what you get here is that it certainly can replace that in extent. But I'd say what you're going to now get is you have the ability to create incredibly new, more complex games. You know, somebody, you know, one of the things we've seen is people creating a lot of these like easy to generate vibe coded games, but the assets are simple or the same. Now I can go into, you know, a tool like this with a bunch of, you know, idea, you know, items that I've, you know, created and create a very complex world. It took us a minute, you know, to make this thing.
Yeah.
And that actually generated an animation of it, but it, you know, took me a minute to create this thing. I could in the afternoon create, you know, a Blade Runner type scenario or scene and have that ready to go. Now I'm trying a little thing in the background here, which is I'm going to use a new tool, which I think people could try if you're kind of curious, which is Codex. So just give me 1 second there. I want you to make this asset. So I'm typing a thing in here. Explain that in a second. But you know, Justin, feel free to fill the void.
Yeah, sorry. I actually turned off the TV because the UPS is screaming at me, and then it messed up your shot. And so now, on the fly, live during a podcast, I'm troubleshooting, which is always fun. Take it away, Justin. You're the one voice.
Hey, everybody. You want to know what the funniest thing about 3D models are? Well, it's that third dimension, after all, poking you right in the eye. Not flat like these other 2D models. A 3D model is something that you can really wrap your hands around, literally, if you were to produce it physically, as opposed to just look at it. What, honestly, I mean, I'm going to underline this again. Just going and playing around with some of these models is a great way to just sort of understand where we're at in terms of how quickly some of the branching of this tech is. And it's easy to lose sight of that, because right now we have a very unfocused view, in my opinion, of AI, that we look at the few products that exist that are, you know, being provided by some of the biggest companies on the planet. But what is sort of lost is, you know, under the surface, a lot of this kind of artistic stuff here, which I think is probably going to have just as much, if not more, of an impact on some of the creative arts and even some of the business side stuff. Like there's just a you know, such an ability to create this stuff.
Yeah, I think about the times that I spent a lot of time searching through catalogs looking for 3D assets and stuff. Now I think about if I can spend that time starting with sketches. Like what I love about the new GPT-4 image model, if you haven't played with the image model in ChatGPT, it's fantastic. You can grab like 5 images of something and put it together and combine it. We've been working on a project where we had to do some set design. And so early on, we just took some photos of chairs in the scene we're in and said, throw those chairs in there. But also for taking just sketches and stuff, you can do like a really, you could take a couple example pieces of art and then just a terrible thumb sketch, but of what you want, like place me here, put this in my hand, and it'll do that. And it's kind of amazing.
Brian, have you ever, have you tried stunt doubling yourself? Oh, is Brian not there?
Yes, I have.
No, I have not, Justin. Sorry. You know, it's a difficult nut to crack is how to solve for your UPS drawing too much power while you don't know which devices you can unplug.
Gotcha. Sorry. I didn't realize that you were not at the con there. Well, for all the listeners, this is a fun thing because the ChatGPT new image model is very, very capable. You can put a photo of yourself and then just say, recreate this photo, and what you're going to get is your stunt double. it looks enough like you. It would look like you if they were running or doing karate or something that would happen in a stunt double in a movie, but it won't exactly be you. But I find it endlessly funny whenever, you know, you throw something in there and you just say, make it a movie poster or remove a background or something like that. It's always, it's a perfect stunt double.
Yeah, I am. Oh, there we go. I'm going to try to see if a little experiment ran here. And no, if you want to play around with code, a very cool thing to play with is OpenAI and Anthropic has their version called Cloud Code, Claude Code, new thing. But they have a thing. And what you can do is you can go in and basically put this in your command line. And what that will allow you to do is then basically try to say, build me a simple app or build a thing. And it's just, it's free. I mean, other than you have to use your OpenAI key. And so that's a pretty neat thing. So I use that a lot to start projects. And so I'm frozen emotionally, but that's fine.
No, I think I've just about got us. Check this out. Here we go. Display number 3. Hey.
Hey.
Successfully rebuilt an engine mid-flight.
Look at that. Look at that.
There we go.
And that's the kind of stuff that you should reward us for. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go if you want to support this show. Thank you very much for everybody who does it. And we will continue to bring you this long-running peek into the world of the weird, the technology that will shape our future.
We had a conversation earlier this week to go talk to some people at OpenAI working on some cool stuff. And Justin, do you think the pace of development is going to slow down?
No, I do not think that it is going to slow down. I was having a conversation with our friend Andrew Heaton last night, because he just did an episode about AI, and he was, he has a friend of his that he views as kind of an ombudsman to his program, and his episode on AI was very optimistic, but his ombudsman gave him a call and he said, when you really look at it, it might be a little bit more hype than it is substance and blah, 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 blah. And I, was there for my friend, and we're sitting in a limo driving from a high school in Thornton, Indiana, different story. But I'm like, trust me. It is not hype. I have been to the forges where I am watching the future being melded, and I come here to tell you, it is only going to accelerate. There is no brakes on this car, and I think that by the time that we are now beginning spring. Spring has sprung here at the beginning of May. By the time that we get to the other side of the summer, it's going to make where we are right now look like a joke, in my opinion.
I don't know that, we might run into some scaling issue because, I don't see that. I think we keep finding solutions around it. There was the update with the fact that Grok 3 wasn't really substantially better than the other model. It's supposed to have been trained much longer and deeper. GPT 4.5 was deeply capable in some ways, but on the evals didn't really show that.
Yeah.
And I would say that, but then we had the reasoning models. And meanwhile, O3, like there are people on Twitter and my feed that just having transcendent experiences using the O3 model. And I feel that it's like, yeah, because there are things between the evals that these models can be exceptional at. But there could be some big blocker for some things. But the amount of utility we get right now from these models, and even the reasoning models, are kind of built on a version of a 2.5-year-old technology of GPT-4. When I hear the kind of the naysayers, one, I find out they don't really spend much time with these systems. They might like, oh, I did a thing and it didn't work. I'm like, that's not the most empirical thing. They're not like, no, I did an exhaustive thing across this thing, talked to a lot of other people telling me they're getting utility out of it. I never hear it from there. Like, because I know
Well, keep in mind, we see some of the same structures. We've seen it when it came to 1970s fraudsters claiming to have supernatural powers. And that is just a cognitive bias. Like in the case of the 1970s pseudoscience scam artists, the scientists who tested them would design the test protocols. And they would, because they couldn't imagine how it could be done, therefore it must be ESP. It is the same cognitive bias that is revealing itself when it comes to AI denialism, where it's like, because they cannot imagine what it'll be good for, this, that, or the other, it must not be good.
Yeah, and I think the problem is just that you have to update your opinions on these things. You can be overly optimistic and you have to update and say, okay, it's not where we thought it was. It's 2025 and, you know, agentic systems can still be brittle and fall apart. On the other hand, I do talk to some of the pessimists and realize that they don't have a state of, they have no understanding of what changed between now and 12 months ago, like literally no idea. And if I ask them, oh, can you name somebody prominent in the medical field using this? They won't. They're just not aware of it. And, you know, can you tell me, you know, what percent of code is being generated at? And they're like, I don't know. And if you said, well, like, hey, 80% of code at Google is, they're like, well, you know, that's their problem. They have this like idea, well, they're all stupid and don't know what they're doing. I'm like, well, maybe. And, you know, my kind of biggest kind of response I use a lot is somebody who couldn't predict where we were going to be, you know, you couldn't predict today a year ago or 2 years ago, could not predict anywhere, was directionally completely wrong about where we are right now. Why would I trust their instincts about the future? And there's been a couple of the AI naysayers that you just don't see in the news anymore because they were just so famously wrong. They're just more of a, they're kind of the Uri Geller of AI. It's just a clown show if you have them on. But they'll still get some places to speak. But again, I don't know where it'll be next year, but I can tell you what it is right now and what it is right now.
Yeah. The one thing is like, I don't think that we have productized the capabilities of the models that we have today. Like, and that's why I'm like, all right, by the time that we get to the next month, if we just go on a linear path of finding where this tech meets our needs as humans, by August, September, we're just going to have more of these products. We're going to have more of these things that are actually going to make our lives better on a daily basis. And that's before you get to the jumps in the frontier, which continue to happen regularly. And so even if we were in a world where that slowed, I think for the average person, you're probably still going to have 5 or 6 new products that are going to be like, wow, my life is now different because I have these, in a way that the internet gave us that back in the late 90s, early 2000s, leading through to, you know, the 2010s. It was like every other week, oh, here's a cool new website. That's great that this new website exists. It makes my life different and better. We are going to continue to get that. And that's before you even factor in that this tech is going to be, you know, continue to get better and do things that we had not previously thought possible.
I think a lot now about things that were fringe but possible, and what happens when you have acceleration with AI as far as our ability to process information and, you know, what was fringe, what may be realistic now. I watched a video, PBS Spacetime, which was the company that I brought in, the producers behind that, Kornhaber and Brown. I brought them in to help me produce videos when I worked at OpenAI because they're just super brilliant. They just have a recent video which talked about transmitting energy, quantum transmission of energy. And they kind of point out that, like, you can't pull energy out of the vacuum, but you can put energy into it and pull it out somewhere else. And that made me think about, like, I think, you know, I was watching the video. I don't know if it has to be super local, whatever, but I was like, well, that's an interesting idea if we figure this out. And some things scale, some things don't. There was a paper that came out recently, by the way, that said that they actually were able to derive power from the Earth's magnetic field. By basically, they figured out an apparatus that was able to kind of generate, like, passively as the Earth rotates, you know, it would get it from the Earth's magnetic field. And it was like, looked pretty legit, like they were actually able to do that. And then it was funny, you see the speculation of like, ah, we've cracked this and now we can, you know, think of what we can solve for energy. And I'm like, well, this is interesting, but they mention it's not a lot of energy, and there's not a lot. And then in physics, there's not a lot. And I went to deep research to say, could you tell me how much energy it would take to like power a phone? And it was something like a stack of these, this systems, the size of the Empire State Building.
Oh, Jesus.
And so it's one of these things where, you know, before in a billion years, you'll never get the amount of energy out that it took to build your system to get the energy. It doesn't mean it has no utility,
yeah,
but it does mean that, you know, the energy you get is, you know, just not going to really be worthwhile.
Well, and, so it sounds like it's a little bit more, your beef is not so much with the core research efforts so much as the breathless headlines that, you know, that overstate the benefit, or.
I don't even that. I would say there's a, you know, and there's this sort of a mentality, it's sort of in sometimes in social media of like, those idiots didn't realize we could have done this all along, or, you know, Nikola Tesla was right. Or it's like, well, I mean, yes, but no. And it was just this sort of like, you know, it's the person that told you that, you know, oh, the gas, you know, the my uncle knows a guy that built an engine that could, you know, go 1,000 miles on a gallon of gas, but they wouldn't let him build it. You know?
Yeah, they are keeping them down.
And remember, the most famous they that I recall was, well, other than, you know, they can cure cancer, but they won't, because people who are,
because they won't make money on healthy people. It's like, no, people who are alive pay a lot of money to stay alive.
Yeah. I was like, well, how come I was able to get LASIK? Like, yeah. You'd think the optometrist would have shut that down.
Big optometry.
Yeah. And then, but then, yeah, the other one was why we can't have electric cars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was
the electric car. Remember that awesome documentary?
With, yeah, it began just, with my good friend Ed Begley Jr. crying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were told we're told the automotive industry and big oil just was the reason we couldn't have electric cars. And then, you know, a crazy South African dude built one anyways, apparently. And so I think that, like, do I think that there's sometimes, you know, you watch remember the movie Tucker, you know, and like kind of a love the movie, but the theory is like, they'll just shut down, you know, really clever inventors. And I do think there's all kinds of resistance that go against inventors and creators, like Richard Branson, you know, having, you know, British Airways, mm-hmm. like what he went through to go through there, and Elon Musk having to fight, you know, basically people within the government did not want him to be able to launch rockets from the Air Force facility in California, and like, and had to sue the government to do this. And everybody's like, no, you don't do that. Because if these are your prospective clients, you don't sue them. And he's like, they're not our clients now, you know? Yeah. And so I do think there's incredible resistance, but sometimes you do get through. And anyhow, my perception is just this, aha, it's the ancient secret they're keeping from us. But that's neither here nor there. The idea though, that if you think about that, you know, if you could transmit energy like that, you know, through some quantum means, what does that mean for space travel? What does that mean for a lot of things? The idea that I can have a power station at one point and I can have something else somewhere else, that means near light speed, totally doable in, you know, some theoretical framework. And I'm hesitant too now to say, like, when we do time frames, because everybody's time frame is completely off now, because nobody had on the cards in 2025 these incredibly powerful agentic systems that can, like, you know, do research.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, like, go find every research paper ever written on this topic, go through, summarize, find similarities, find some hidden things there, and to give me some thoughts on it that haven't been explored. These systems can do that now, and 5 years from now, don't even
know. I mean, because they can do it constantly over and over and over again, and, you know, squeeze every bit of juice based on, you know, our current understanding of something, which is insane to think of, and then do its own research, which is wild.
So I had a societal thought that popped into my mind. You know, as one of the things that LLMs and our understanding of them has really shown a spotlight on in my mind that really surprised me is how much, I mentioned this before, there was some moment that I said, oh, well, LLMs begin their sentence not knowing how it's going to end, ... just like humans. And that word, those words came out naturally, but then I was like, oh my God, we really do that. We start talking not knowing how we're going to end the sentence. And then that got me thinking, how else are we like LLMs? And that led me to thinking about network effects of who we bump into our modes of communication, everything from micro expressions to body posture to, you know, to the way we physically present tells a story that instantly conveys whether or not someone's excited, relaxed, you know, looking for work or distracted, all those things. And that got me onto the subject that I want to bring to you guys. The idea that, and as far as I know, you guys can push back if you know otherwise, we really are, every human is the average of the five people closest in their lives by net worth, by weight, by, you know, physical capabilities, by, you know, all those things. And so there is a benefit. That is the reason that people go to networking events, is to physically just be around. And it makes sense. I mean, if there's a normal distribution of everything from IQ to communication skills, to ability to see tasks to completion, then it makes sense that people born into rich families would just grow up around rich opportunities. And maybe they're a goofus, but they're still a rich goofus, et cetera, et cetera. It had me wondering that, like, if somebody, it made me think of the Diamond Age in that book. There's a young lady's primer that is powered by artificial intelligence, where somebody grows up outside of her station. Her class is very, very lower class, but this book, this magic AI book, fills her head with high-end, Victorian, well-educated stories and ideas, talking about logic and mathematics, and she ends up growing. This is while living in the gutter. She gets a Cinderella story existence, and it occurred to me, we can do that today, right now. If you are a family who makes, you know, not a lot of money, you can make, or if you're a person who wants to be upwardly mobile, you can set the rules for your GPT to say, I want you to talk to, you know, I am somebody who makes $1 million a year, and I want you to talk to me like that. And I want to reconcile what's so broken about this bank account. And then when it says, well, have you sold your company yet? And you're like, oh, I've forgotten how to do that. The point being, the more of these conversations you have, the more your neurons rewire and buckle up to enter that strata where you fit in congruently with everyone else. There kind of is a cheat code to going past it now. And I don't know if that sounds like crazy talk to you guys or not.
I think that we saw kind of with the invention of the book, you know, the invention of the book was the idea that you could be in any class at any level, but if you had exposure to somebody else's great ideas, then you could do that. And that's why a lot of, you know, to be trained, a classical education is the idea that you can benefit from the learnings of the last several thousand years of Western civilization. And I do think that is profound. Sometimes you meet highly self-educated people and you find out what it was is, you know, they discovered reading early on and were able to do that. But the next step, though, is to be able to converse and talk to, you know, we have those friends who are very self-educated, but not tested and never really had their, I had a friend in high school who was one of the smartest people I knew, but he didn't like to be challenged and kind of moved back to a very rural town and then was, you know, liked being the smartest guy there. But he had trouble when he was in a city and in a room. And I have friends that are very smart, but you put them in a room with a bunch of other smart people and they do not do well because they're not used to not being the smartest person in the room. And I think that's what's exciting about these models, though, is the idea that you could in the future, if you want to shape the path of your children's education, et cetera, is like, cool, be more challenging. I want you to be more intellectually rigorous. Yeah. Do this.
Yeah, that you can have a very specific and regimented push to get you to where you are, because theoretically the ideas would meet you where you were and be able to run as fast as you could. I mean, I think we think a lot of our current education paradigm is written around the idea of like dredging up the back of the class, right? Like we want to create a thing that can push as many people through these hoops as you can, these check marks as you can. And then obviously you have like gifted classes, but we have like one mode above, right? It's like, okay, you can have a gifted class, you can have an AP class. And then if you're Doogie Howser, you can go to college at 11 or something, right? Like that's where we've maxed out on the smartest people on the planet, where now there's going to be so many more gradients of, hey, where are you right now in your lesson? Are you Are you really feeling it? Do you want to continue to blast through it? Like you can now just rip this, this stuff, you know, because the hard work, the bottlenecks of, I need to make a lesson. I need to test you. I need to see where your aptitude is. That is now, you know, so much quicker, so much easier to do.
You think about when you start to get embodied systems and robots and the idea that, you know, while you're sitting on your computer, your kid can be on the floor with their teddy bear, instruct them in art. Mm-hmm. And we need to be clear that, you know, the job of the parent is the parent and the job of robots and toys is to be in toys or instructions and stuff. And, but I think that there's a very interesting sort of world where your household has multiple autonomous systems doing things along what your goal is, and not to spend less time doing the nurturing and the things that we want to do, but actually give us more time to do those kinds of things.
You know, I was thinking about this, and this isn't necessarily an AI thing, but it is certainly an internet culture one. The rise of music festivals and just physical meetings of general interest. And it hit me when I was watching the NFL draft, which obviously the NFL is very popular. But a few years ago, the NFL decided that they were not going to hold their NFL draft in the Radio City Music Hall, where you would have, you know, a couple hundred fans, usually from New York, that would gather. They tried to get fans from all the teams, but usually it was New York people because it was in New York. And a few years ago, they decided they were going to make it a traveling road show. They would do it in varying different NFL cities, usually the cold ones because it's nicer in the spring. But this year it was in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And if you've never been to Green Bay, Wisconsin, it is an incredibly small town. There is not an easy way to get there. It is not next to a major airport. You have to really kind of go out of your way to be there. And there was, I'm going to guess, and somebody can look up the exact number for day one, like 70,000 people. It was like somewhere between 30 and 70,000 people that were there to watch what is essentially a listicle. Like it's not a particularly riveting a visual thing. It's the commissioner of the league coming out and saying a name and then an 18-year-old possibly hugging him. And that's that. And I was like, why is this popular? Why do people want to go do it? And what I've come to is just, we're so separated and siloed that if there is a thing that you can connect to other people on, mm-hmm. I'm going to go. It is essentially NFL con. That's what that is. It is just the ability to be in a space with other people who want to talk about this thing. That is now more valuable than ever. And I think for us, it's a little old hat because we come out of these internet and nerd and geek communities that are, that, you know, have been doing cons forever. They were the forebears of it, like so many things in culture that geek and nerddom stuff kind of tends to be. But now it's mainstream, and I guess it was one of the things that I've been kind of, it's been crazy to wrap my head around because I'm aged out of the point where I would really, really, really want to go stand next to people to go experience it. But the crowd was young; it was like super young, and it was a bunch of people going out there and partying, watching names being read, and it is, I don't know. I think that we're only going to keep having more of them.
It reminds me, it's like the joke about the guy wearing the Steelers jersey making fun of the kid dressed up in cosplay.
Yes.
And it's the only difference.
Literal thing that happens in Atlanta every year.
Dragon Con. Yeah.
Dragon Con. Like, hey, nerd, what are you doing? Is they're wearing their Kansas City Chiefs hats and this or the Falcons. And it's like, I don't think you play for them. I'm pretty sure you don't play. I'm pretty sure that's not your name on the back of the jersey, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's fascinating. Like my wife and I have been spending time at Disney and something came up about, and we're not like, if somebody asked me, are you like Disney adults? Like, no, he's like going there because it's just fun to do it. But and then we're do something and the D23 came up. My wife like, what's D23? Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's like a super fan club for Disney, you know? Yeah. And then I started thinking about like I don't mean this pejorative, but like, there's a cult. Like there's a real cult there, you know, like, you know, there's performative ways, but not in the negative ways of like, don't talk about it. Like, please talk about it. But it was just this, like, here's a way to dress or here's a way to do this or religion or whatever we want to do. Like this is like, cause from the outside, like, oh yeah. And you can join this, do this membership here. You go to these events, you do this, you can do this thing called hinge trading and do all these other things. And I don't get it, but I know people like it and it's not hurting me. So, you know, that's fine.
I suspect a lot of it is a physical location where everyone speaks the same language. And I know that we don't, it sounds like hyperbole to say that, you know, geeks and jocks, nerds and jocks speak different languages, but the only thing lacking is a political border. Like when you look at Norwegian versus Swedish, the two languages, they could talk to each other and they're closer than trying to express ideas in, you know, football language versus Klingon. Well, in that case, a literal language, but in Star Trek analogies. And to be in the same place where everybody speaks your language, and you get a more frictionless, high speed exchange of ideas. So that totally tracks, and especially, you know, sprinkle on top of that some deep, deep desire to get back to physical interactions post pandemic. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do think it's only going to increase though, because if you look at where to get back to AI, I do wonder whether or not our culture continues to splinter, like we continue to find exactly what we want to talk about. And we find the people that want to talk exactly what we want to talk about, whether or not AI either exacerbates that, it continues that trend where we find deeper and deeper fractals, or maybe we go through the looking glass and AI is something that binds these like tribes that have fractured and splintered into such thin communities. Maybe AI is like, oh, did you know that you have a lot in common with these 90 other fractional communities? And we find we begin to come back together. We begin to find something closer to a mainstream.
I want to touch on one more topic which we haven't addressed, and it's not related to AI. It's one of our favorite crazy companies, Colossal Biosciences.
Okay.
For the uninitiated, these are the folks bringing them back. Real life Jurassic Park.
Yes.
I guess what era would it be? Pre-human or early human history?
Yeah. Well, you hear the latest about the whole direwolf.
Yeah. Well, it's some percentage of a direwolf, right?
Yeah, so this is the controversy. So what they did was they were able to get hold of the genetic sequence of direwolves, an extinct species as a wolf. And then they took forget what wolf, like a timber wolf or some other species of wolf. Then they went through and they changed several of the genes to match the direwolf genes. And they said, hey, we've brought back the direwolf. And some people are like, well, you didn't clone it directly from direwolf DNA, and you're selective about which genes you used. Is that direwolf or is it not? And I don't have an answer to that, but they've actually cloned puppies now that, you know, we're going to see as they grow, and direwolves are a bit huskier and bigger than other wolves. And so it might manifest some of the features. We talked about this a long time ago too, which was when we're talking about dinosaurs and how if you're cloning a dinosaur, maybe, you know, you don't want to bring back exactly a T-Rex because like oxygen levels and other things have changed since then, the environment, you might make certain modifications from that. And you know what, it's one of the things I think that is probably a silly conversation now. I mean, still it will be a silly conversation in the future because we're ultimately going to like not realize that's not really what mattered. But I would say that it is this sort of interesting point we're saying, like, well, what is it, you know, is this thing a wolf or not a wolf, dire wolf?
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, for lack of a better term, this is eco-poetry, right? It's like, the thing is like, there's a temptation to believe that there's a thing called nature before man, but it's like, well, which era would you like? They all look very different, you know? And so there is no restoring back to a pristine original nature. Instead, there's simply eco-poetry, like why build megafauna and release them into North America? Because you would like the land to look however it's going to look after you create megafauna and release them into North America. Anything beyond that, I wonder how many people... It would be interesting to hear interviews from all the people working on it on what motivates them in that regard.
I think that for part of them, as they look at like helping the environment and the idea that you could help restore, I think there's a part of excuse is to be able to say that like, hey, we can, our environment might benefit from having some of these, you know, apex creatures and whatnot. And there's a big debate there. I do think it is this idea of being able, like they also want to bring back the dodo, you know? And I think there's this idea of, can we fix a thing? Can we fix a thing that we did?
Yeah, that one actually seems like there is a within living memory, a oops, my bad undo that we can do. Like, and we can be like, yep, we're now back to how we were before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number one, I didn't know the dire wolf was real. I thought it was just a Game of Thrones thing. I was unaware that it was an actual real thing that had gone extinct. So that was my first thought of it about it. I was kind of baffled by some of the naysaying of the like, well, it's not really a dire wolf. And it's like, yeah, they're dead, dude. this is going to be a recreation of it. I don't think that anybody's running away from that. You can't just reach back in time and grab them. You are doing your best with science.
Yeah, I don't have a strong opinion on it. I do think it's pretty amazing. And I think that over time, you know, what seems like a big deal to us now is not going to be as big of a big deal before. And I think it's going to come into the function. And I do think that, you know, I'm curious, like, I want to see them bring back other things. You know, one of the things they want to bring back is like, they want to basically recreate, you know, they want to do the woolly mammoth, but their plan is to basically take an Indian elephant and then make it hairy.
Yeah. Well, at first,
hair and then,
baby steps until the thing you have seems to match 99.9999% of the DNA that you find entombed in ice. At that point, it's pretty much.
I don't think that's necessarily the goal. I don't think they're trying to get to a perfect genetic representation. I think they want it just to fit in the ecosystem.
And I guess that does check my box. It's like, well, if what you want is the effects of a woolly mammoth and the aesthetic of a woolly mammoth, beyond that, how much do you care? Because not even nature would stick to any one plan.
Yeah, I'm all aboard whatever. I mean, I just want to see these things. So
yeah.
So we're all for this. We're all in
support. Hell yeah.
I know technically the recipe for a more universally approachable podcast is to add someone who disagrees with us, but I really enjoy just all of us agreeing that it's awesome.
Awesome. Let's go. Full throttle.
Yeah, but we could get counterpoints and counterpoints and counterpoints to stuff and, you know, sure.
This is why I've told you guys, if I ran the Jurassic Park franchise, every movie would just be another park going wrong. Yeah. And every movie would begin with them saying, wait, you're really opening another park after it went wrong the last seven times? And somebody's going to be like, yup. That's what and the rides are different and the dinosaurs are different. But every time, look. The most popular versions of that movie are always the one where the park goes wrong. And then they do other stuff. Oh, after the park, now we're going to go through an old park. And now people, dinosaurs are pets. No one cares about that. We want to see a T-Rex rip a Tilt-A-Whirl in half. That's what we always want to see.
Let me give you a counterpoint because, you know, we're starting to see this with the Star Wars universe. They're finally not making it lightsabers 24/7. Like, I would love a movie that looks like another Jurassic Park, But then it's like, well, we got to get ready for the big Raptor football game. And then at some point, sure, you get so caught up in the drama of these Raptors that don't, that are underfunded in a corner of the park that get trained up, that all of a sudden you forget to cheer for the park going wrong. You just want to see the bad news Raptors.
I'm down, but spectacle. We need a bunch of people in a place when everything goes wrong. That's my only thing.
I have a different take.
Okay.
I'm all for. We watched the trailer last night for the new Jurassic Park movie, and I'm like, all they want is dinosaurs eating people. That's all they want. Like, oh, the danger to our ecosystem and no.
Get out of here.
So it's like walking. You know what I love about Walking Dead?
Mm-hmm.
It stayed true.
Yep. We need to go get water. Well, all right. Zombies, you go by yourself. All right. Yeah,
zombies. Oops. And
there were zombies there.
Terrible decisions. That's it. They created an empire on that. Like literally, I do have a pitch, which I'll throw this out there, which I have. If I had more bandwidth, I'd try to do it. My agent knew Michael Crichton. She learned the industry from my Erica Silverman, who's she's been a wonderful, wonderful person to me, and just she's a saint to me. And she learned the industry because she followed Michael Crichton around, you know, the film and TV meetings and all this sort of stuff. And he showed her the ropes of that. And they have done other stuff with Michael Crichton's IP. They did a book about a volcano where they took an idea he had. If I had the time and I was able to push for this, I would love to write the prequels, the story of Hammond making the park, starting early on. Because remember, mm-hmm, in the book, you talk about like the miniature elephants and all these other little things and this stuff. It's like,
One of my favorite scenes in the book that has never been adapted into any of the versions of the Jurassic Park movies that I've seen is Hammond going to get money and like putting on the table this like gnarled, weird, like minimum viable product dinosaur that is like not impressive, but it's impressive enough that he's done it that they're like, fine, here's money. And it's like, that's one of the coolest ideas ever.
Yeah, like where did they get the money? What happened with, you know, who were the early investors and what was going on, the experiments and stuff? What else were they doing? I think you could do this thing set in like the 1980s and 90s of, mm-hmm, this super sort of weird, you know, research thing. I think you make a great miniseries too. Like, I would love the pre-Jurassic Park story because, man, we get to the park opens, but like, there was as somebody works at an AI lab, there was a lot of trial and error that went on there.
Yeah.
All right, let's do picks.
My pick is the first 15 minutes of Andor season 2. I've seen it 3 times. That's all I've seen. I've been very busy. And so my little treat every night is to, this time I'm going to try to finish the whole thing. Although I will get, actually my pick will be the Called Shot experiment. I don't know if you know this, Andrew, but over on the Cord Killers podcast, Tom Merritt and I have started doing this. It started off as kind of a stunt, an experiment, but it's become like a legit good podcast. The theory that we were testing is when you're in polite company and somebody asks, oh, you've seen so-and-so or whatever, there are so many shows, like, I'm not going to watch all of Fringe. I'm not going to get the full experience on that. But then we had the idea of, well, what if you watched the pilot episode, the first episode, the highest rated episode, the ultimate episode, the lowest rated episode, and the last episode, FULL, would you then give or take have the full experience? And so every month we take a different show that has finished its run and we give it the full experience trial. That's how we experienced the West Wing. That's how we did The Wire. That's how we did The Shield. And then number one, we evaluate whether or not they stand up. The Outer Limits, MASH, all of these shows. But number two, we're also testing the theory, and we have a new opportunity just because the time winds up just right. We're in the middle of doing the full experience on Moonlighting. So we have the last episode is this week. And then we had to pick what we're going to do for the next month. And even though Andor hasn't ended, we talked about, I correctly, it turns out, according to Diego Luna, predicted that the purpose of Andor season 2 is to recontextualize Rogue One so that what was techno babble about faction this and faction that will now have meaning and possibly look like a much better movie. So I've only seen Rogue One the first time. And then the second time will be at the end of the full experience. We're going to start Andor this next week. And then we'll watch the ultimate, because by then the show will have ended and we'll have the data of what the highest rated episode was. Then we'll watch the lowest rated and the last, and then we'll rewatch Rogue One. So that's my pick is join me on the full experience of Andor.
Yeah, I would say, the challenge with watching Andor out of sequence or whatever is that it's like this, they're like the last season was three arcs.
Yeah.
And you don't, it's like a sitcom kind of thing. I've watched the first three episodes of Andor.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a really good 80-minute first episode there. You seen it, Justin?
No, not yet.
Yeah, I think they had a, and I'm like, man, I'm a third way through here. Like, wow, a lot of table setting, particularly where each three episodes is supposed to be its own mini movie. And this was a movie. Stuck in the first act and there was a, you'll see. It's good. It's well done. Awesome. Well done.
Good.
But,
all right.
Character stuff, but I was like, expectations, I would lower them.
Got you.
Speaking of low expectations, our Justin, did you have your pick?
Oh, my pick is The Righteous Gemstones, which is going to end its run this weekend. So you would be able to do the full experience, Brian, after this Sunday's episode. They did a penultimate episode last week, and it felt like their season finales in the past. So I am very excited to see where they go with their series finale, because I do think that show, on top of being just absolutely gut-bustingly funny and one of the best cast shows ever, I often find my inner monologue just being Uncle Baby Billy's voice and things that I'm frustrated with. I want to tell to shut up, nerd. But it's also got heart, and when the show wants to kind of flex that, it's able to do it. So I'm excited, because I think that they're going to lean more into the earnestness of, what David Gordon Green and, that creative team is able to do. So, I'm sad it's going away, but I am pumped to see it.
I think I'm three episodes or four episodes in the new season. I've been a bit let down. The direction was really bad the first couple, like the shots, and there's really weird stuff. And I felt like there was a lot of regression. So I hope it gets better. But I was like, the first episode was fun.
Yeah.
The Bradley Cooper flashback. But I was like, man, this is like, I don't feel like we're five seasons into these characters from where we were. But so speaking of low expectations, went and saw Thunderbolts last night.
Ah, yes.
And you get a vibe when you watch the trailers for stuff, and the trailers, whenever you play like a rock soundtrack or whatever, and you're trying to show everybody a good time, or you get somebody who says a line and somebody in completely different location has another response line, like that kind of joke. You're like, you're literally making a joke in the trailer that doesn't exist in the movie, because a very, very bad feeling about it. Unfortunately, I can't say that it's better than Endgame, but it's probably right up there, Far From Home, as my favorite Marvel movie in the last 6 years.
Wow. Orange Cat in the chat said Thunderbolts is the best thing since Endgame.
I love Far From Home, but I will not argue. My wife said the same thing. I would say it will either hit for you or not. And if you come away going, I will not blame you. I don't want to spoil stuff or whatever. And it's but because I would say that don't avoid what you can. Not that there's like, oh, big, but there is you kind of know the story, but the way they do the story, the way it resolves all the sort of stuff. There had been talk about like, oh, these characters could be some of the new faces of the MCU. And I would say 24 hours ago, I'd say, oh, Jesus Christ, really? Like, I can't even remember their names, this group. Now I'm like, kind of sick of the old Marvel and ready for this version of it. One of the things I heard somebody say was like, it's like The Boys if it wasn't written by a bunch of, angsty edgelords, trying to like trigger your nerves and not just like... I don't want to oversell it. I don't want people thinking like, oh, I would just say that it was like, it's a build. And I'm like, I don't know how I'll take it the second watch through, because the pacing, there's but they do the pacing is used for characters. They are building characters that are probably going to be around for a long time. I had been joking. I think I said this to Justin, which was, what if, because I heard some, you know, some of the reviews that came out from were good, but that was also like Disney does a weird thing where they're selective who they give it to. Like, so I don't know. You hear like, it was like this, like the thing they say about Star Wars TV shows. They always start off really high and you realize they're complete crap. You know, because, you know, Mickey Mouse shows up with a bunch of photos of the blogger at some fan con in a compromising position and says, you know, you gotta get a good review. Yeah, right now it's 96% audience score, right? And again, opening night's going to be hardcore, but it's not like, you know, not like a Thunderbolts had a huge fan base to show up for that. But I'm the joke I'm saying though is like, what if Thunderbolts is the good one this summer and Fantastic Four is the one that sucks?
Oh, don't you talk that way. No. Why not both? We can have both.
Oh, we hope that Kevin Feige woke up and that's why Daredevil was good. And that's why Thunderbolts is good. And hopefully Fantastic Four is good.
Yeah. My issue I'd say right now with FF, and again, I'm a big Nat Shackman, the guy who's directing it, big, huge fan. I think he's amazing, but it's also like, I think I know the whole plot to this movie from just the trailers. And if you're kind of a Marvel fan, which I think the execution would be, but also it's, there's can I say a thing?
Min Wong just shouted, Kevin Feige woke up.
Are you going to guess the plot of Fantastic Four?
The monsters in the water tower?
No, I'll tell you a movie that I'll go. It probably is going to be like.
What's that? Go ahead.
It'll be like The Empire Strikes Back of the MCU.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you're saying
I read a plot leak. So I think I know the plot.
Okay. You know what? Yeah. That would track. This is me. I don't have the amazing movie prediction insight that Andrew has, and I have not read any spoils like Justin has. So I feel, in fact, I'm not going to look for reactions while I speculate. If it were to be like an Empire Strikes Back, then it would track I could picture we haven't seen Dr. Doom. They haven't said anything about Dr. Doom. Keeping my eyes closed. I could picture Dr. Doom being in the movie, that being really great, and Galactus straight up eating Earth and they escape to the traditional MCU universe. I could picture something like that. That's what I'm imagining.
We'll see. And I think that, and I would say I'll defend, even if we have a plot that we've already predicted, it's in the telling that'll make the difference and make
That's so. my fear about Fantastic Four is that the cast doesn't have any chemistry in the trailers. Like that's my fear. My fear is that it's like it, I'm not saying they won't in the movie, and maybe they're trying to hide one of the plot that they have, but it doesn't feel like they're like, I don't know, crackling. There's not a whole lot of like, man, I really think these guys love each other when they really need to love each other.
I think the bar for Thunderbolts have been set pretty high on like team ups. Like the last time I watched a group together come together in a movie and I loved it was Guardians.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I do call me heretic. I am a big James Gunn fan. Guardians 2 and Guardians 3, I can do without. I just don't think they're very good structurally. I don't think they're good. I know people love Guardians 3, and that's fine. I just don't think it's a good movie. I think Guardians 2 is a bad movie. I think Guardians 3 is not a good movie. I think Guardians 2, I couldn't handle all the kind of the clapter of like, you know, the taser face thing. Like, so literally you have to have, you're having characters laugh at a dumb joke. So we all think it's a fun joke, but it's really nowhere near the level of writing we got at, like, you know, Peacemaker. You know, like I know what he's capable of. But anyhow. Thunderbolts had great chemistry. I'll say that.
Let me ask you the comp. The James Gunn comp would not be Guardians, although obviously it will be compared to that. But Thunderbolts as a concept has similarities to the Suicide Squad. How would those two compare?
I think that there are sincere moments in the Suicide Squad with characters you like, but we spend a lot of time in their own, and we get each character sort of like their screw ups, whatever. These people, Thunderbolts, I would say they felt like the most realistic characters in the MCU. and particularly, you know, Walker, you know, U.S. agent, you know, former Captain America, you know, for a minute. Like I love, he was the only thing I loved about, you know, Falcon and Winter Soldier. He was the one storyline that I actually enjoyed. That him and he was Isaiah. Like I like the Isaiah story was in. I wanted the Isaiah story. I didn't want the other story. And that was like one of the many things made Brave New World so terrible was like, there are all these other interesting stories we could have got and we didn't get this. We literally got Timu, Captain America, Winter Soldier. I mean, literally that's what, if you go break down the plot of Brave New World, it's like down to, you know, here's Timu, Black Widow. Here's, you know, Timu version of, Winter Soldier, who's Timu this. It's always just lesser versions of everything in that. And so we'll talk, but like the idea that Thunderbolts is this new superhero team that's not quite as great as other superhero teams is kind of what makes it awesome. So I would say that I like the earnestness a bit more in this, in my take. And it just felt realistic.
Did you see the A24 knockoff trailer that they did for Thunderbolts?
No.
Marvel did a like prestige indie movie trailer for Thunderbolts. And that was when I think I knew like, okay, Marvel thinks that they have something here. Like,
if this did not have the name Marvel on it, you know, and it was some other director had done this, it would be, critics would be championing this from the rooftops that this is what Marvel needs to be. They need to do this because it's, you know, Absolute Cinema. That's the one, right? Yeah. So, I'll check that out. Yeah.
Yeah. We can watch that after we wrap up the program.
Okay, cool. Yep. Sounds great. It's been weird. Go see Thunderbolts.